Hello and welcome to What About Us? Cultural Awareness and Clinical Practice. My name's Kate Cooper and today I'm bringing you an interview from the wonderful Dr. Mary Griggs. Mary's a clinical psychologist who specialises in working with refugees and asylum seekers, as well as with the deaf community. And today we talked about what got her into working in these two very different areas of psychology, and we explored her experiences of working with these two different groups and crossing different types of communication barriers. We also spoke about how she positions herself as a white British person and a hearing person working with these two very different groups. So over to the interview now.
Thank you so much, Mary, for agreeing to take part in the podcast today. So just to start off, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about your background and what it is you do.
So I'm a clinical psychologist and I'm based in Bristol and I work for AWP Mental Health Trust. So I'm the clinical lead for two small services. One is the traumatic stress service and particularly the asylum seeker care pathway, and the other is the deaf service, which is a service for people who are deaf and predominantly sign language users. So rather than people with a hearing loss, they're people who are deaf. They sound, as when I'm saying it, they sound like such disparate fields.
But yeah, and that was something that I wanted to ask you about, really. What drew you to those two areas that do seem quite different?
Yeah, that's interesting. So the deaf field, my dad actually is a vicar for deaf people. And so I learned to sign when I was about, I guess, seven, eight, something like that. Kind of developed an understanding of the deaf community, which I sort of continued through school and through university a little bit. I did a project on the expression of emotion in sign language and so on. So I was quite interested in sign language and the sort of psychology bit. Then when I finished my degree, I did a PhD in deafness and mental health, which looked at the cultural construction of kind of well-being in the deaf community. And then decided I didn't want to stay in academia and wanted to be a bit more frontline, so sort of retrained in clinical psychology and had a bit of a break from the deaf community, so sort of trained and then worked in mainstream psychology for a bit and then sort of brought the two together. And then I guess in the background, my family have always worked in sort of refugee field in different ways. And I went to Atlantic College for the sixth form, which is a kind of international sixth form college in South Wales that, with people from all kinds of different backgrounds. And I think probably there I just became absolutely captivated by the idea, you know, the kind of idea of cultural difference. And there were people from refugee backgrounds, although, you know, lots of people from non-refugee, much more kind of privileged backgrounds. So sort of carried on with that interest. And I think probably it's a human rights political thing, isn't it? You know, it became part of me a little bit, and that's continued over the years. So when I did my clinical psychology training, I was really lucky and managed to do my elective placement at the Medical Foundation for Victims of Torture, now called Freedom from Torture. And that gave me some really solid skills in working in this area. And so kind of managed to carry on doing that over the last sort of 15 years or so. Now I'm kind of split between the two clinical fields, but actually maybe we'll go into that a little bit, but I think there probably are some similarities there, something that draws you to both areas.
And it sounds like from a young age, you you kind of met with deaf people and kind of got to know that community. And similarly, at sixth form, you got to know people from different cultural backgrounds.
It's funny, isn't it, that the when you're 16 at college, you know, it's a brilliant age to meet people from different backgrounds. You know, your mind is wide open. You have, you know, so much energy and, you know, and kind of, I think in that situation that the college actually ran rescue services, and the idea was that you, rather than kind of learning in a sort of stale, sort of dry way about different communities, we were actually working together to sort of rescue people, quite literally. You know, some people did different kinds of services, but they did run the beach rescue, the cliff rescue, the coast guard. So I remember when I was there, it was when was that, 1987, it was a sort of Iraq-Iran conflict, and there was at some point a student from Iraq and Iran were in a boat together rescuing someone else. I mean, it's quite a kind of, you know, strange image now, you know, but at the time it was just really important that was the focus, you know, that there were meetings about how we felt about each other. And, you know, when we thought about countries, we just thought about the people from those countries, and that became a way of understanding that had so much power and resonance. You know, I think that's probably what's continued, is just the need to understand, in some ways, kind of conflict and suffering and human action and so on, but from understanding the people, you know, from really getting to know the people. Deaf field, I think it's funny, maybe there are some slight differences there, I don't know, that I feel like I've got to know the deaf community. You can never be an insider in the deaf community if you're hearing, but you can, over the years, I think I've kind of moved a little closer, and I can kind of, I've had so much experience of the difficulties that deaf people go through, I kind of feel like I understand the story really well. I can't feel the distress, but I can understand the story. And it probably, you know, actually maybe there are similarities, that it's through hearing those stories over and over again, and meeting people and so on, and through the language, probably being able to make a connection and kind of represent people's views sometimes.
And you've kind of started talking a little bit about the similarities and differences between working with these two seemingly quite disparate groups. I suppose one of the things I wanted to ask you about was in terms of using language, so either working through an interpreter or working with the deaf community, kind of how does that work in your practice?
It's such an interesting area, and actually when I did my clinical psychology training, my research was in using interpreters with asylum seekers, and it kind of fascinates me a little bit. I think the thing about the working with deaf people is that you can work in sign language one-to-one, and you feel like you have a unique insight, because you can, you know, I probably describe myself as a fluent signer, but I feel like I can connect very directly with people, and that's enables me to sort of work out what can be most helpful to people who are in distress. And I think probably there's a slight difference there, in that you always require another person to do it with in a spoken language. I don't have any fluency in any spoken languages. So it's kind of about it feels like the setting up a therapeutic alliance is actually setting up a working relationship between me and the interpreter and the service user. And I have a kind of hunch about the mechanics of it and what needs to happen for it to work. And that's probably based on doing it hundreds of times, you know, in terms of seating and whether people talk in the first person or not. And you can kind of learn to do that. But there's a little bit that you have to just wait and feel. And it's about how the dynamic actually needs to be, how it works best, how it doesn't work, you know, what kind of, and that takes time. And it kind of, it probably takes a number of sessions to sort of work that out, and it probably takes time every session to settle to the point that we're actually able to do some work, you know, do some therapeutic work together. And I think the sort of style of that relationship varies across, you know, different cultures, different languages, certainly with different service users. And it's kind of, it's quite fascinating how it emerges, you know, it's, but it kind of, it definitely does, you know. I think probably the thing that I would say has transferred from the deaf work to the working with asylum seekers and refugees is the idea that you can quite effectively and safely use different components, different people to achieve something. It doesn't all have to be with one person. So, for example, working with deaf people, we might use a relay interpreter. And a relay interpreter is a deaf person who's trained as an interpreter who relays between different sign languages. So, for example, if a deaf person has a learning difficulty in a court situation, you would have a relay interpreter who would move between more formal sign language and the kind of more idiosyncratic language that the deaf person has, or simpler sign language. And that role has become quite established in the deaf community. And sometimes I would use a relay interpreter if I was struggling to communicate with somebody, because I don't have that intuitive kind of deaf thing that, you know, that deaf relays have. But it works, you know. So, for example, I once did an assessment of a deaf asylum seeker. Doesn't happen often, but it was an Iranian Farsi sign language speaker, and I kind of thought, actually, there's no way I can communicate directly. So we had a deaf relay who was able to kind of communicate between Farsi sign language amazingly and kind of British sign language, and then we had another British sign language interpreter for the poor hearing co-assessor who didn't know anything about the deaf world and thought, you know, that was probably quite a deep learning curve. But I think in that situation, you feel that you need to have myself and the deaf relay, you know, that's the package. And there's a kind of an ease of communication then between us, that people know what their role is. And, you know, I think that kind of works. So whenever people say to me, oh, it's, you know, must be difficult using interpreters, I sort of think, no, actually, my experience is mostly the opposite, that with a good interpreter, it somehow allows something to happen that can be so effective and, you know, so moving often. But it kind of allows the interpreter to bring in some of the cultural stuff sometimes, some of the body language, some of the, you know, the bits that I can't get at, you know, and then I'm there. So it's kind of, I think it can work.
So it sounds like even though it can take some time and learning in the room to kind of navigate having multiple different people and their perspectives, actually, once that's established, it means that you can kind of get deeper and do more useful work with people by having somebody who speaks their language but also has the cultural understanding.
That's exactly it. And I think that setting up process is a bit of a mixture of being confident and directive in certain things and being able to step back and sort of pause and reflect in other things, you know. Okay. So you need to kind of know that, I'm probably a nightmare to work with. I've just realized. Turn up and I kind of say, right, this is how we, but there are certain things that you just, I really think I certainly need to set up, you know. So I find it distracting if, for example, an interpreter isn't talking in the first person. So if they're saying, you know, he says they've done this, or he says, they have to become the person in order for us to still be one whole, you know. So certain things to do with the way the room is set up, the way the chairs are set up, so the eye contact, the shifting eye contact is minimised, that the interpreter is clear about the things that, you know, that they will interrupt a session for, and the things that will be talked about afterwards can be reflected on after, stuff like that. I think you kind of have to know, you know, need to set it up and be directive in that. But then the other bits that are about you observing how, what people's facial expressions are like when they're talking, what the relationship seems to feel like, you know, what kind of transference is around the room. You know, I think this, like, probably slightly more nebulous stuff is the things that are about kind of observing the relationship evolving. You know, the some of those things you kind of have to pause and just see those things evolve and accept that they, you know, you can't write the kind of guidance for that. You have to actually kind of be led. and a lot of that is about the kind of, you know, it's sometimes the age and gender of the interpreter will be a big factor in dictating that. You know, I work with a fantastic Afghan interpreter I know he has a status in the community as well, and he has, you know, a lot of people know him and respect him, and that's really obvious in the room, that there's a kind of a paternalism that comes with him, his work, and that can really help, yeah. But we also need to be aware of it, you know. We need to know how that works if someone is saying something difficult or talking about things that intrinsically they feel ashamed of or conflicted about. It's important to have that conversation both with the interpreter, with this interpreter, for example, before the session and after the session. That's important.
And how does that process of kind of trying to navigate somebody else's culture and communicating directly or more indirectly through an interpreter, how does that compare with you as a hearing person, but someone who's fluent in BSL, communicating with people from the deaf community?
Oh, that's so interesting. No, it's a funny one that in many ways, there are, on the face of it, there are more similarities between me and other deaf people, in terms of, you know, we live in the same country, we have this sort of similar lifestyle and so on. But the difference, I think, for me is there's a powerful dynamic within the deaf community that deaf people are really, really fed up, pissed off with the oppression, the barriers, the kind of the fact that, of course, someone hasn't booked an interpreter, or they're not, you know, they can't access things, or of course the helpline is just a phone number, there's no email or SMS. This happens on a daily basis. The stress of being deaf in a hearing world, I think, is really immense. But it can kind of sometimes create a sort of an understandable antagonism with hearing people. You know, people are angry that this is, you know, this is yet again another barrier. And in the, certainly in the past, I've often felt that deaf people working with finally a hearing person they can communicate with, you know, who isn't an interpreter, there's a lot of that kind of, oh, you probably wouldn't understand. And a lot of the anger comes to what, you know, it can feel like that's a very big dynamic in the room to work with, you know. And the relief of working with my deaf colleague, for example, can be really, really palpable. So I kind of feel like that dynamic is quite, quite strong. And I'm very aware of my hearing status. You know, people have written papers on the position hearing people take as hearing people in a deaf world, you know, whether you're kind of apologetic or whether you're, you know, whatever it is, you have a position as a hearing person. And that is a big factor in a therapeutic relationship. You know, you're constantly aware of it. You know, I think in working in other cross-cultural settings, it's a totally different dynamic. There's a kind of inevitably, and unfortunately, there's a power dynamic because you're a professional, you know, you're called doctor, you have power, and that's definitely there. The rest of it feels like a difference at which I'm as kind of disabled as they are. I don't know what it feels like to be kind of running from the Taliban. I don't know what it feels like to be trafficked. I kind of want to know, but I kind of have to tread very gently. It's it feels like a journey of kind of being curious about where somebody comes from, trying to kind of get alongside, but also being really mindful of the fact that you can't possibly imagine what it's like. You can try and meet someone in a place where they can talk about their distress and talk about what they want to address. And I think at that point, it's about getting as close as you can, but kind of recognizing that it's very difficult and it's a very sensitive, sort of fragile journey. I think I'm probably thinking about it that I do two kinds of work, two phases of trauma work with asylum seekers and refugees. We run psychoeducation groups and also the therapy. So that's the therapy is a second phase. And I think for the groups, it's often about trying to find kind of as culturally neutral as possible ways of explaining how trauma affects the brain and basically how people can manage themselves to kind of find ways of managing symptoms of PTSD. I would really like to develop a kind of peer mentor sort of role within those groups, because there are so many times when perhaps the interpreter, having done the group many times, will step in and give different metaphors or will give ways of explaining things that I couldn't possibly have come up with myself, but feel really helpful. So I kind of think there are definitely for that more kind of imparting information sort of role, it would be really important to develop that role and kind of peer mentor role. And for the therapy, I suppose it's a slightly different process.
And in those groups, do you have people from many different cultural backgrounds joining?
Well, it's a kind of pre-COVID, post-COVID sort of change. We always had people from many different backgrounds in the groups, which were pre-COVID were bigger. We perhaps had 8 to 10 service users and up to kind of 4 interpreters, and that mix worked pretty well. We tried to make sure that there were always a couple of people who didn't need interpreters, so that there were some people who were using interpreters and some that weren't. But it was never, apart from the one women's group where we had a lot of Albanian women, there were never more than a couple of people with one interpreter. Post-COVID, the groups are now much smaller. They're kind of more like 4 people. And because we need to minimise the number of people in the room, we have single language groups. So we never planned to pilot this, but we have ended up kind of looking at what changes when you have a single language group. And actually, it's been an amazing journey. We at the moment we're running a Pashto group for Afghan men, and we've never done this before, but because the group are all Afghan, the kind of cohesion in the group is really good. It's really strong, and we do a kind of relaxation exercise towards the end of the group, which helps people kind of put into practice some of the deep muscle relaxation. And one of the guys in the group suggested that he led the relaxation exercise. So now we take it in turns, and each week someone else leads the relaxation group, which is fantastic. I'm not sure we could really do it if we had such a mixture, but it works so well. With another single language group, we run an Arabic group, but people are from different countries, and I think you feel that the group has a different dynamic probably because of that. So I don't know. I think there are real benefits, but it's always worked people have found, I think, that the common experience of PTSD and the way it leaves you feeling, and being an asylum seeker and the way that leaves you feeling, and the complexities of kind of awful housing and poverty and often physical pain and illness and so on, and, you know, and PTSD. I think when in a group situation, people are so reassured by the fact that other people, that they're not going mad, really, that other people have been through things that are probably as horrific and have the same kind of symptoms, and, you know, can, and we can kind of come together on the basis that we can't solve everybody's problems, but we can give people tools to try to manage some of those symptoms, that I kind of found in the multicultural groups, that after a couple of weeks of the group kind of forming, that creates a cohesion which has, you know, which has real value, you know, that people find really helpful. So I don't think it hasn't made a huge difference that there've been kind of different nationalities within a group. The thing I do insist on is that we've got interpreters that are experienced, so they almost act as a kind of scaffolding for the group, that we have the same two or three or four interpreters who know the material, who can role model the kind of, you know, reassurance, and they'll do the relaxation exercise, for example, with us, and, you know, they'll join in occasionally with responding to questions, and it just feels like that kind of helps the group form, you know, as a real value.
It sounds like everything you've been talking about kind of building that good relationship with the service users, and kind of, yeah, trying to foster that positive dynamic in the room, it's super important to have interpreters who are kind of able to do that in a group setting.
Definitely.
And another way that COVID is helping us to learn about the really important ingredients in what we do, frustrating as it all is, it is good to hear about ways that's helping kind of shape and understand how services can work in the future.
Yeah, and actually we tried to do the group online, because I think we you know, obviously being encouraged to do a lot of clinical work online, but we couldn't do it. It didn't work. We tried, you know. I think there was so much that I hadn't realised until we tried to do it online. There's so much in body language and eye contact, and, you know, it's not all about kind of passively giving over information. It's actually about the dynamic, and it felt very stunted, very difficult to kind of create a dynamic online, you know. Yeah,
absolutely. I know that one as well.
Yeah.
So I've kind of come to the end of the things that I wanted to ask you about, Mary, but I just wondered if there was anything else that you wanted to add before we finish today.
No, I think it's been really interesting reflecting on this. I often feel like I have to apologise for the fact that, you know, I represent such different services. It doesn't seem to make sense, and actually I think there are some, you know, there are some sort of commonalities between the two, you know, the use of interpreters, and I do think that I guess the only thing to add might be that the thing for me that is really fundamental to the way I work is not assuming that we have the same goal in mind in terms of well-being. You know, that it's such a kind of a cultural, personal thing. And maybe that is something which is very much common to both those fields, is actually kind of looking at what the goal of well-being is, you know, what people would settle for in terms of mental health, you know, and kind of what people are working towards.
From everything you've said today, it's clear that you work in a really, really individualized way, no matter what culture someone's from. And when crossing very different types of cultural divide with refugee and asylum seekers and the deaf community. So, yeah, it's been so interesting to hear your perspectives on working with those groups today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that's all for today. Thank you so much to Mary for giving up her time to talk to us on the podcast today. And do remember to tune in to our next episode of What About Us next month. We'll be right back.